Wow.
And what was the maximum frequency you were putting through those resistors?
120 cycles.
I think you said 120. In other words, that was a full wave rectified voltage was going through that non-inductive resistor. Is that what you're saying? 60 cycles, full wave rectified would make 120. Over to you, John.
Yes, 120 cycles. They said they were good up to 1,000. No problem. They said it would work to 1,000 cycles, and no inductive response would be had from them. And we never did any problems with them. Well, they were extremely rugged. The porcelain ones and the ceramic-based ones were only like 200 watts, 250 watts. And boy, they got hot. They could operate almost where you could see the redness in the wires and work perfectly.
The wire that got red and still behaved correctly, do you believe that was a special kind of high-temperature wire? Ordinary copper wire, for instance, or nichrome wire. Maybe you can take high temperature there, I'm not sure. What's your guess as to what the material was that was glowing in a dark room, John? Go ahead.
It had a heavy silver base to it, Dick. If you were to, when you looked at it, it looked pretty rough. But if you started to file it or polish it, you would see it was sterling silver and it would buff up beautifully. But it had a very high silver content. What the base metal that was mixed with it, I don't know. I'm just trying to give it a quick, it could have been copper. Or beryllium, maybe.
And the silver on the outside, which is probably done to make sure you had very good contact, electroplated silver is my guess. When that's running at high temperature, does that take on a tarnish, John? Go ahead.
Well, they tarnish just from the salts in the air, Dick, along with the temperature. But no, the silver content is distributed throughout the resistor. If you were to cut it with a hacksaw, you would basically see the same color all the way through. Although you could see the glint of copper or something like that in there. I know it wasn't gold.
Well, you're talking about numbers like 100,000 watts. I'm guessing this is an extremely high power supply for ship electronics, a Navy ship or a merchant marine ship. Is that approximately what this was, John? Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, these were armature bias resistors for high current, and their values vary from like 0.4 ohms to 3 ohms, 4 ohms in that area.
Wow, unusual. Very rarely do we in our circuits get down to such low number of ohms, with one exception. You can buy these nice little surface mount resistors rated for numbers like 1/8 of a watt, 1/4 watt, 1/2 watt, 1 watt, which have numbers like 1/10 of an ohm or 0.05 ohm. And what they're used for is you put them in series with the lead that you care about. You get very little voltage drop because the resistance is so small. But because the resistance is so precisely made, by putting some kind of a voltage sensing device across that resistor, you now know the exact amount of current that's flowing in that wire. So there are kinds of power supplies where you want to build a current limit capability in the power supply. You have one of these very low number of ohm series resistors going to a couple of the leads of the integrated circuit that's part of this electronic regulated power supply. And when that set current is exceeded by, say for instance, you don't want to go above 5 amperes, and 5 amperes on a 0.01 ohm resistor would be 0.05 volts. And if you exceed 50 millivolts, the integrated circuit says, aha, I've hit the current limit, and it starts folding back the power supply. It starts going into some kind of a protect mode, so that the power supply is protected from short circuits. Fold-back type power supply. Let me drop it. My favorite kind of power supply protection circuit, if you're building a high reliability power supply for, let's say, a military Air Force airplane, which is the one that I was working on at the time, the B-1 bomber, you don't want to put a fuse in the power supply, because under battle conditions, the fuse blows, the power supply is now disconnected, that circuit is no longer working, and you're about to be shot out of the sky. You don't really do that. So you want to have some kind of a self-protect on the power supply that automatically restores itself when the fault has been removed, whatever created the short circuit, so to speak. And there are various people who have built circuits which will cyclically try to turn the power supply back on. I don't like those. So the one that's most reliable in my mind is the so-called current fold-back power supply, where if the power supply is good for 15 amperes under normal conditions, and you try to draw 20 amps out of the power supply, it folds itself back to where instead of putting out 15 volts, it puts out a fraction of a volt, and only puts out a fraction of an ampere, but it is doing the equivalent of an ohmmeter test. In other words, by the voltage it's putting out, the current it's putting out, it knows whether or not you have the right amount of load resistance out there that's going to draw 15 amperes or less at 15 volts. And when it sees that condition, it automatically restores itself, and it can do that in microseconds. So a fallback power supply, to me, is the safest way to go, because during the short circuit condition, the power supply is not sitting there generating a whole lot of heat, trying to generate a whole lot of current or voltage. It's going into a kind of an idling mode, but it is alive and active, waiting for you to remove the fault that made it go into that fallback current mode. And as soon as you remove the fault, which might be a short circuit, within a microsecond...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Within a microsecond, that power supply, once you remove the fault, is back to full operation. And so that's the safest way to protect and yet have as much operation as possible under real battle conditions, if you know what I mean. So a number of the significant power supplies on the command control, let's see now, what was it now, the surveillance receiver on the B-1 bomber, are those schematic, are those power supplies, are those voltage regulator fallback networks were my design. And here I claim to be a microwave engineer who really likes RF circuits. And how in the world was I tolerating somebody saying, hey, Dick, for the next couple of months, you design some power supplies for us? And I said, yes, because I know that those power supplies are going into some very fancy transmitters and receivers, and I wanted those transmitters and receivers to have high reliability. There's some real good electrical engineering smarts that goes into a power supply. There are people who might be graduating from a good school with an electrical engineering degree, and they say, gee, I don't want to work for some grunt electronic company like a Long Island Power Authority or Consolidated Edison. I want to do real engineering. Slow down a little bit with that decision. You'd be amazed how much real engineering goes into a massive network like Con Ed or Connecticut Power and Light or Long Island Power Authority or whatever, New Jersey Power and Light. You'd be amazed how much real engineering goes into those systems. And for, let me drop... I know that Mr. Cuomo, our governor of New York State, said that the Long Island Power Authority did a terrible job. Well, that's easy to say. I wish he would say what they should have done instead. The fact that, yes, you have ratepayers on Long Island who were trying to call up and get an answer of, when will my power be restored? There was no answer. I mean, some of those people waited for 14 days for some darn good reasons. I mean, what should they have done instead? Hire more people from California, Texas, and Florida? Who's going to pay for that? Were they available? Everybody on the East Coast was trying to tap into that that workforce, if you know what I mean, to do all that repairing. And even if you could pay for it, even if you could hire more people, what are you going to do with them? You can't use 9 women simultaneously and give birth in 1 month, if you know what I mean. Unless you've got all the raw materials and ways of properly coordinating all those people, if you can afford them and if you could get them. And so, and if you don't have enough raw materials ready to go, somebody's going to say, well, you didn't have a big enough storeroom of raw materials. You didn't put enough stock on site. Well, when you buy a whole lot of spare material, you're paying the money up front. You're paying taxes on that stuff that's in the warehouse. And so... No matter how you do it, there's no ideal solution. If you bought too much material, you'd be wasting money. If you bought too little material, it wouldn't be available when you had it. If you hired more people, you'd be wasting more money. If you didn't hire enough people, you wouldn't be getting the work done fast enough. And when all those people arrived on Long Island, let me drop. What's the best thing you can do with them? And you set them to work to start repairing things immediately. You could, if you want to, spend 2 weeks having them do a survey, go up and down every block and find out how bad the damage is. And then you put that into some kind of a great big matrix, some kind of cross-file system, and you try to figure out where you're going to display the resources. Well, during those couple of weeks that you're doing all that survey, nothing is getting fixed, and people are going to be screaming and hollering. 90-some-odd% of Long Island was out of power simultaneously. You try to find out where's the power out, you assume it's out everywhere. And that's damn close to that was the 90% accurate answer. So no matter how you do it, somebody's going to say you didn't do it right. It's very easy to criticize. What should they have done instead? To say you're going to replace all those people and you're going to resell the business and you're going to resell the hardware, how do you know you're not jumping out of the pan into the fire? So, and we've had various people sign into the TechNet soon after the Hurricane Sandy situation. Let me drop. We had various people sign in saying, yeah, they were doing a slipshod job. I said, really? Describe to me what is slipshod. If you had a broken telephone pole and they poured a brand new telephone pole in, was that bad? If you had broken wiring and they put in brand new wiring, was that bad? Where they splice the wire and they're using a code accepted splicing device, was that bad? I kept asking people, yeah, all this slipshod work you're talking about, describe to me what was slipshod. I never got a coherent answer. What was slipshod? The fact that they did it fast, in other words, they arrived on your block and two hours later the thing was working, so because they did it fast, that means it was slipshod. What was the slipshod? What should they have done instead? The guys that appeared in front of my house where there was a tree laying across my wire and about to break it, my drop from the telephone pole to my house goes across a county road. And a tree was laying on that wire and bringing it down to the road level, didn't quite break it. They arrived at my house at something like 7 or 8 o'clock at night, in the dark, with all kinds of fancy lighting and a cherry picker, and they're cutting down those trees. And I talked to those guys. I forget where they came from. They were way outside of state, and they were working from 7 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock every night, 6 days a week, doing that work. And I gave them a tip. I was very happy they came along. They did a beautiful job. So, all these complaints about slipshod workmanship, can anybody describe to me what that was? Give me your call letters right now. I know I'm off subject. K2RW in the TechNet. That silence to me is deafening. Hey, John, go to the very next mailbag. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
Another thing, too, people don't understand when you bring a team into an area and you have a pole, you can only put so many men in a manhole, you can only put so many men on a pole. So if there is 1,000 men to go to work and you have 500 locations, you know, okay, 2 men at each location and they get the work done. That is pandering politicians. They're talking about something they actually have no expertise in. So what they're saying means nothing. Slipshod. Okay, you have a 250,000 wire running up on a pole, and they go up and say, well, it's 250,000. I've got another one in the truck, and they splice another 250,000 wire on it. What else do you want them to do? You're 100% right. You cannot listen to those kind of people. What they should be doing is have the experts, the installers, the engineers get together and say, what can we do better next time? That's really what they should be doing instead of talking about what happened. That's over with. KC2WGB. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one, too. Am I coming through that all right, Dick?
Coming through beautifully. Go right ahead, John.
Another scientist here. Okay. He wants to know what he's discovered. All right. He took what I think is a river rock. That's what it looks like because it's smooth, it's round, it's approximately 6 inches in diameter. When he struck it, he was looking for fossils, which he's not going to find in that kind of rock, but he struck it and it cleaved off a flat piece, almost perfect. Looks very nice. And what he did was, he wound up setting it on a crumpled piece of aluminum foil on the bottom, and he took what looks like a cat whisker, and he took the foil, connected it to the ground of an audio amplifier, and took the cat whisker and probed in different areas of the rock. And he got some ticks and static and all kinds of things happening. And he found that when he left it still in one position, that it would crackle and it would stop. And then maybe 5 minutes later, it would start crackling and get worse. He'd like to know, what did he find and what has he done? Maybe you could help Matt on that one thing. It's 2W2B.
Now, let me see if I understand this correctly. He started off with a round 6-inch diameter, what looked like river rock. Apparently struck it and got some kind of a opening to that rock. I'm not quite sure where the tinfoil went, but maybe he set the rock on a piece of tinfoil that became one of the contacts. And with something like a cat whisker, he's then probing the jagged edge of where he had cleaved the rock. And that, in turn, is going into a high-gain audio amplifier, and he sometimes hears crackling noises. Is that approximately what you just described to me, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
It's exactly right, except the tin foil, he crunched it up into like a ball and then smushed a rock into it so he had multiple contacts, I guess. And the part that cleaved is almost flat, and it's kind of shiny. And it has dark spots and light spots, and that was he was probing around in that area. So he'd like to know what he discovered. What do you think's going on?
Now, there's a beautiful PBS program over the last week or two, something about the genetics of the Neanderthals. We used to believe that the Neanderthal race of hominids, man-like animals, were primitive, more monkey-like. We used to believe that they didn't have language, and we're slowly discovering that they didn't seem to do very much writing and leave stories on the wall, so to speak. Although I think they made some pictures, but we did discover that they made stone tools, and they made some very sophisticated stone tools. They found ways of doing a very difficult rock fracturing process. So that with a very difficult to work with kind of rock, they were making sharp cutting tools. There's reason to believe by the genetics we discovered of the Neanderthals that they had the capability of language. So and the genetics also indicates that we used to believe that they were the lower class humans, and that the higher class humans, the Homo sapiens, simply displaced them. Well, there's lots of evidence that there was inbreeding between the two, and that they have slightly different places of origin, and that the Neanderthals did slowly get bred out because the non-Neanderthals were greater in number. But there was blending inheritance going on here. So they weren't that dumb, they weren't that ugly, if they were intermixing, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Every rock is partially conductive of some kind, depending on what it's made out of. And so when you've got local magnetic fields, when you've got local, there's always 60-cycle fields everywhere in your house. If you just take the center conductor of an RCA phono plug that's plugged into a hi-fi amplifier and you put your finger on it, you're going to hear some 60-cycle hum and other sounds. So there's always local E fields and H fields that are going to be picked up if you've got unshielded wiring. And by way of the various conductance, let me give you another experiment. Way back in my youth, my father and I were reading Popular Science magazine, and we were finding out how to make a crystal set and the sophisticated way of doing it. Let me drop. The sophisticated way of doing it was to go out and buy a Galena crystal and a cat's whisker, and that became the rectifier that you connected to the coil of wire and the antenna in the ground and connected up to your earphones, and you hear the local AM broadcast station. Well, you could also take a razor blade, a Gillette Blue Blade razor blade, and use your cat whisker on it, and if you very carefully probe it, you could find a place where it got rectification. And if you read the articles by Mr. Bose, B-O-S-E, who was doing 60 gigahertz microwave experiments in 1890 in India. He was educated in the United Kingdom, went back to India and did all these experiments, and he was making diode rectifiers by taking a piece of galvanized steel sheet metal, sharpening and making a sharp point out of it, and the sharp point touched another piece of galvanized steel just carefully, and he was able to get diode rectification at 60 gigahertz out of that. He was also able to make stopgap transmitters. So you'd be amazed how many very simple-looking materials will give you rectifiers, diodes, variable resistors, spark gaps, and so on. So the fact that you can take a rock, and it would be an awful lot of fun. Let me drop. It would be an awful lot of fun to put your ohm meter on those two leads between the tinfoil that the rock is embedded in and your cat whisker or the straight pin or whatever you're using. Put your ohm meter between the two, and as you do various probes, measure how many ohms you measure. And it isn't too difficult to build an AC, an alternating current type of ohm meter. Most of the ohm meters we own are the DC type. And in many a circuit, if you measure the ohms between point A and point B with your ohm meter, and then you reverse the two leads, occasionally you'll measure a different number of ohms. And now there's multiple interpretations of that. Is it because of diode-like action you're getting? Is it because of battery-like action? If it turns out that there's a little bit of moisture on that rock, and if it's acting like a battery, in other words, you take those two probes and you put it into the most sensitive voltage reading of your digital voltmeter, and if you read anything above a millivolt, like say, for instance, in one of the experiments I didn't know it, but my circuit was generating 0.6 volts. And when this is where I was trying to make the measurement of how much conductivity there is between my left hand and my right hand when both of them are in a pool of salt water. Let me drop. Okay, now, what I discovered is that because my circuit, because I had an aluminum pot on one side and a stainless steel pot on the other side and salt water in both, I was really building a battery. It was a 0.6 volt battery. And when that 0.6 volt battery action went into my ohm meter probes, in one direction I measured 800 kiloohms, which was crazy, much too high. In the other direction I measured minus 200 kiloohms, which is crazy. How do you get negative ohms on an ohm meter? Well, the battery voltage being shoved back into the ohm meter was driving it crazy. If it was an AC coupled alternating current type of ohm meter, I would have gotten a much more realistic answer even in the presence of the battery voltage. So there's a whole series of experiments he can do as I see it, John. How many volts does he measure on the most sensitive scale of his digital voltmeter? How many ohms does he measure with positive and negative polarity by switching the two leads on the ohm meter while he's doing this various probing? And so just listening to the sound that you get out of a hi-fi amplifier gives you some information, but there's a lot more experiments that can be done there. I'll guarantee that that rock to some degree is electronically conductive. Everything is electronically conductive. And there's the electronic conductance 10 kiloohms, 10 megohms, or 10 gigohms. Very interesting information. Does the rock behave differently when it's moist or when it's dry, or when it's halfway in between the two? And so this cleaved piece of rock, that's not clearly defined circuit element, but I guarantee under certain conditions it has variable resistance, variable battery voltage, variable diode characteristics. So how they originally discovered the cat's whisker gallium crystal.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
newly discovered how to build a diode rectifier for a crystal set. Guaranteed there's a lot of funny stories along those lines. So I know I haven't given you a direct answer, John, but I've given you the hints of some other experiments that can be done with relatively simple instrumentation, like a digital voltmeter and or an oscilloscope and or a vector network analyzer, where you could have a grand old time with that probe under that rock being plugged into a vector network analyzer, and you make those measurements at various frequencies. There's no end to the experiments. What you think is a simple material, a rock, has a lot more going on. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I could think of a few. I would even try heating it. I would also gather more rocks that look different. I mean, these are very, you know, with river rocks, the density is high, these igneous rocks. And he should try a couple of others and split them up. Maybe he found something that's different. Be interesting to see what he does. If he's listening to this later on, I'd like him to try to go further and let me know what he finds out. Go down to that riverbed and pick up a few more of these boys and check them out. But you're right, resistance readings, maybe even capacitance readings, dampen it, moisten it. You're right, look at it on, put an ohm meter on it, or maybe even the voltmeter, and see if he can find a point where he gets a microvolt, and then watch it, see if it varies. Yeah, he could have some fun with that. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one. KC2WGB. Yeah,
just even breathing on it while he's making the measurement of voltage or ohms, or listening to the sound, breathing on it, which means the moisture of his breath is getting on through the cleaved surface of the rock where he's probing it. Changing the temperature, putting the whole thing on a heating plate of some kind, changing the temperature. Rock is not simple. Very few things are simple. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. And even exposing it to high-intensity light, he may have some crystalline structures there that may break down and give him something different. Okay, I'll go on to this antenna question. This one, okay, this is a ham question, and I'm going to have to describe a construct for you. Okay, Dick, this is a 10-meter dipole antenna, simple dipole, which is working fine. He's been using it for about 2 years, lives upstate, and he has the property, and this is what he wants to do. He's going to duplicate two more of the exact same dipole, and he's going to put them in X, Y, Z pattern with the connection points crossing. So you get a picture of what it looks like. He will have three lead-ins coming from those three dipole antennas. Let me let it drop, and I'll get to the question. Okay, so now he won't have to orientate the antenna to go from vertical to horizontal, and he has it facing east-west and north-south on the horizontal plane, and of course straight up and straight down on the vertical. He wants to know if it's worth bringing it into an isolated jack system so that he could pick out the angle quadrants, say one antenna, one facing up, and maybe half of the antenna that's facing west or east. You get the idea. If you need information, let me know. KC2WGB.
You know, by setting up your three dipoles essentially co-located, one parallel to the x-axis, one parallel to the y-axis, one parallel to the z-axis of a Cartesian coordinate system, that gives you almost all of the raw ingredients of doing some very elaborate polarimetry experiments. Bring in those three separate feed lines, assuming they are properly balanced so that you're not getting current flowing in on the outside of the coax, which complicates life. So you got three separate balances going to the three dipoles, or you're feeding the dipoles with three transmission lines that are themselves balanced, like a twin lead. So there's various ways you can make three pure dipoles that are mutually orthogonal, have separate transmission lines with no common mode current flowing on the transmission line. Once you've got that, you've got the raw ingredients to do some very interesting polarimetry experiments. For instance, just using the X and Z dipole, when they are adjusted in such a way, when they are oriented in such a way that they are perpendicular to the incoming wave, in other words, you've got a wave coming from the north, your x-axis goes to the west and your z-axis goes straight up. Under those conditions, by looking at the x and z, you will know, is it stronger in x or stronger in z? That's one approach. By using the x and z transmission line simultaneously, by now combining them with a variable amplitude combiner and variable phase combiner, you can now make an exact measure of polarimetry. A 10 meter signal, let me drop. A 10 meter signal almost always gets to your property by way of an ionospheric reflection. The ionosphere is a very non-pure reflector because it is really a plasma substance that you and I call ionosphere, E layer, F layer, and whatever, F1, F2, and so on, and it's mixed in with a magnetic field, there is a significant amount of polarization rotation as well as simultaneous transmission. In other words, the signal getting from London to your house on Long Island gets there by bouncing two times and bouncing three times, so to speak, just multiple signals, multiple bounces getting to your backyard. By the time they go, each one of them goes through the ionosphere and experiences a certain amount of time delay because of the extra path length and polarization rotation because of the Faraday effect. In other words, whenever you've got a plasma and a simultaneous magnetic field and a radio wave propagating and a radio wave propagating through that plasma, you get polarization rotation. So that signal that got launched in London that was vertical may have twisted two or three times going through the ionosphere on the double bounce mode and arrived horizontal on Long Island. And the other wave that made a triple bounce mode and got to Long Island may end up at a 45 degree slant in polarization. By way of, now you can use the two separate transmission lines in my first experiment now, just talking about the X and Z dipoles. By combining them with the right kind of a network, now, I didn't say this network is super easy to create. Let me drop. It's not super easy to create, but by way of a network where you can combine the amplitude, in other words, you might choose 50% of X and 50% of Z in one particular experiment. Another experiment, you might choose 75% of X and 25% of Z, but you can see, if you can change the amplitude ratio in the way you're combining, and if you can shift the phase of one versus the other, if you had a trombone in one of those transmission lines, so you can change the length of the transmission line by up to 0 to 180 degrees, you can now play with phase delay and amplitude ratio, and you can either do it for choosing the maximum response of reception or the minimum response of reception. In other words, you can use those combinations to null out the signal, which means you've now adjusted the antenna to be thoroughly orthogonal. In other words, if the signal is coming to you with a linear polarization slant 45 degrees to the right, and by the way, you've mixed the two feed lines together in ratio. Let me drop. You mix those two signals together of the right ratio and the right phase so that although the signal is coming to you linear polarized slant 45 degrees to the right, and you've set up your antenna linear polarized slant 45 degrees to the left, you've now made electronically your receiving apparatus is orthogonal at right angles to the signal coming in polarization wise, and you can tune for a null. The advantage of tuning for the null is it's a very sharp tuning, and you'll get a very precise reading. Or simultaneously, you could decide to, otherwise you could decide to tune for the peak, so that the signal is coming to you at slant 45 right, and you set electronically your antenna by using the right mixing ratio and the right phases to be slant 45 right, you'll get maximum signal. But now if the signal has a major axis and a minor axis, because it really is an elliptical signal, and the elliptical signal has the major axis slant 45 degrees to the right, and it's got a axial ratio of 2 to 1, so to speak. In other words, the major axis and the minor axis differ by 2 to 1, and you set your antenna that way, you'll get maximum signal. And simultaneously, believe it or not, with elliptical polarization, if it's a slant 45 right major axis, and you set it for slant 45 degree left major axis, and if it is a clockwise circular elliptical polarized wave coming in, and you set your antenna for counterclockwise slant 45 left, you can see that step by step, you can create orthogonality. You make the major axis at right angles to the major axis. You make the direction of polarization elliptical rotation, clockwise versus counterclockwise. You make it opposite. You now will create an extremely sharp null. So once you've got a null...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Once you've got one or two or three orthogonal antennas with separate polarization, separate feed lines, and the right kind of a network, and to build this network with simple switches in a box, which allows you to switch the signals together in phase or out of phase, with various amplitude ratios, which could be done with potentiometers, resistor potentiometers. You can make them work at 30 megacycles quite well with the right kind of a small wiring, if you know what I mean, sample wiring. You can make the ratios being combined with resistors. You can make the in-phase and out-of-phase combinations. The phase shifting is a little bit more difficult to do, but by having those separate feed lines coming into the shack, my goodness, can you do a lot of experiments. You can now find out that on Monday, that signal comes in from London, and it's slant 45 degree linear. On Tuesday, the signal comes in with nearly pure circular polarization clockwise. On Wednesday, the signal comes in with the major axis slant 45 degrees to the left, elliptical polarization with a 2 to 1 ratio. Very few amateurs have known that this is possible. Very few amateurs have done this. But looking at the statistics of the polarimetry of the signal arriving on Long Island from your same friend in London who's making a transmission to you on each schedule with you at 7 o'clock at night, so to speak. Let me drop. You make these schedules from night to night and look at the statistics of the signal strength and the signal polarimetry that arrives, and you start collecting that data for a significant period of time. Guarantee you're going to see trends where what is the ionosphere doing? What is the Van Allen belt doing? What was the amount of solar flux of the solar wind from the sun? What was it doing that particular? There's all kinds of ways of correlating this. Where was it with reference to the sunspot cycle? It turns out that the radio astronomers have been doing this for 30 years. A really well-designed radio telescope not only is looking at the amount of noise coming from that particular star, but by looking at the polarimetry of that noise, you can find ways of finding out what was the local magnetic field like in the vicinity of that star. And you can find that out by polarimetry. Now, this is not radio astronomy we're talking about, but as you can see, this friend of yours is doing an extremely interesting science experiment that could... This could become a doctoral thesis, and I'm not kidding. I guarantee that this carried far enough could become a doctoral thesis as to the statistics of polarimetry of arrival of signals of that particular guy in London or that particular high-frequency broadcast station or whatever. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, this really sounds interesting. Wow, he can have a lot of fun with this. But one of his other ends of the question was, would it pay to have it split up enough so that he could use one element of each dipole, say only one element of the east-west dipole, and the one upright, so he would have a 90-degree that's what he would wind up. He would have a 90 degree, and he could switch that in any direction. Would he also wants to know if he should wire for that. Would that be any benefit other than using them as combined three separate dipoles being combined in different fashions?
Now, what I just described, John, is I tried to keep it simple, and I used only one horizontal element and one vertical element, and I made them mechanically broadside to the signal coming from London, assuming that the signal from London always arrives by the Great Circle Path between London and Long Island, in my example. You and I know that there periodically the signal will arrive by some other path. Instead of short path, it'll take the long path. Occasionally, it'll reflect off a cloud somewhere else and come in at some other crazy angle. So, by having his three orthogonal, thoroughly isolated dipoles, and by the way, you can easily measure how successful you are by setting up the transmission lines, the balance, and whatever, by measuring the isolation. If he transmits 1 watt into the Z antenna, how much signal appears into the X antenna and the Y antenna? If he's got a real good setup, 25 or 30 dB weaker will be the signal on the other antennas because they're at right angles. Then he knows he's got high isolation. So the amount of isolation he can measure, and he can mechanically tweak the antenna to peak up that isolation. Once he gets maximum isolation between the X, Y, and the Z antenna, let me drop. Once he gets maximum isolation between the three antennas, then the answers he gets out of them will be most pure. If he's got a lot of coupling between the two, then it takes a lot more interpretation to figure out what is really going on. But now he's got an X, a Y, and a Z, and he's got a switching matrix box where he can decide he listens to only X, or only Y, or only Z, or he combines X and Y, or he combines X and Z, or he combines Y and Z, and now he changes, or maybe he listens to all three simultaneously, X plus Y plus Z. But by changing the ratios, whether or not that particular element is turned on, the ratios and the phase shift between the two, he now has the ability to not only measure the polarimetry of the Great Circle Path coming from London to Long Island, in my example, but he could also find out whether or not the signal was coming in by the long path. With the right kind of a setup like this, he can really find out what was the angle of arrival of the signal. Can he do it in azimuth and elevation? Let me think about that one now. He'd really have to build up a pair of these vertically stacked XYZ antenna. He's got one at near ground level and another one 10 feet higher, so to speak, and he's now comparing those in order to get elevation angle of arrival. But still, you can see the raw ingredients is here to measure angle of arrival in azimuth, angle of arrival in elevation, polarimetry of arrival for the Great Circle Path, possibly polarimetry of arrival of the long path. He's got the raw ingredients to make a lot of measurements. So that switching matrix box, he's going to want to have the ability to turn on one at a time, two at a time, various amplitude ratios, various phase shifts between them. And although it sounds very elaborate, that so-called switching matrix box could be done with fairly inexpensive switches.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
28 megacycles with very good mechanical wiring can be done in a way there where the stray inductance is fairly low, the stray capacitance is fairly low. So mini boxes or something a little bit bigger could be done with that switching matrix that brings in those three transmission lines and allows you all of the switchability and adaptability. I didn't say it's easy. I didn't say that there's a simple article you can go to. If you simply Google the word radio astronomy polarimetry, it'll give you a hell of a lot of hints. And just plain polarimetry and radio polarimetry and radio science. Turns out that that's what we're really talking about here when it comes to something, a whole field that's called radio science. In other words, how does that signal behave with what you and I would call laboratory instrumentation, but it's really done with that laboratory instrumentation in the backyard, if you know what I mean. So there's a vast field of capability here that has been very poorly investigated at the amateur level. Quite a bit of it has been done. Let me drop. When it comes to the professional radio astronomers, they've been doing a lot of this for 30 years. When it comes to radio amateurs, and this is getting dangerously close to what you and I would call a phased array antenna, John, because now we can start building up arrays of these things, volumetric array of them, deciding how you're going to feed them. And so there's no end of how simple you can do this or how complex you could do this. And step by step, once you understand the theory of operation, there's a lot that can be done with this. This can definitely turn into a doctoral thesis if you carry it far enough. And the average amateur hasn't even scratched the surface in this area, John. Very few articles exist on it. A lot of internet articles on radio astronomy polarimetry, but amateur radio-wise, I'll be amazed if there's been two articles in the last 20 years. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun with this. One other point he mentions here, the center of the XYZ, he can only get that up 35 feet. Do you think that'll be sufficient? And right now it sounds like it's going to be worth his efforts. But at 35 feet, you think he'll be okay?
Yes, I do, John. There is no ideal altitude. If this is the best of all worlds, this XYZ array, this, what's the word I'm looking at? Cartesian coordinate, simultaneously orthogonal, triple antenna thing, the sensing network. If this is the best of all worlds, it would be located 1 mile behind the space shuttle in orbit, and you make measurements. Once you locate an antenna like this in your backyard, there is no ideal altitude. You're always going to be getting some ground reflection. You're going to be getting some sifting action from the trees, the nearby buildings, and whatever. Life's going to get a little bit more complicated because whenever you think you're testing an antenna, you think you're measuring the parameters, you're measuring the gain and the beam width and whatever of an antenna. It's very different than measuring an amplifier in the bench. You put an amplifier in the bench, which has got an input connector, an output connector, and you connect it to a real good vector network analyzer. You can now measure in a vector manner what is the input impedance, what is the output impedance, what's the truth, what's the forward gain characteristic, amplitude and phase, what's the reverse gain, amplitude and phase. You put an amplifier on the bench with the right instrumentation, you really measure that amplifier. You take that exact same vector network analyzer, put it in your backyard, and you think you're going to test your antenna. Let me drop. In reality, you're testing a combination of your antenna and the environment you put the antenna in. It's extremely difficult to really test the antenna in isolation. If you had a whole lot of money, you can build a real good anechoic chamber, a chamber that has no echoes at your operating frequencies, and you put a transmitting antenna at one end of the chamber, a receiving antenna under test at the other end of the chamber, and if all the echoes of all the walls have been eliminated, now you're measuring the antenna. But that's an extremely expensive endeavor to build that anechoic chamber. A smart amateur can get something very close to that performance by doing what's called the reflective ground plane antenna testing procedure by Dick Turin, W2IMU. The antenna handbook, ARRL antenna book, under the chapter of transmission lines and antenna testing, will show you how to set up a backyard antenna range where you intentionally know you're going to be getting ground reflection, and by carefully setting up the transmitting site and the receiving site, you learn to tune out the effects of the ground reflection. Now, can he do that? Let me drop it. The next question is, in his backyard, can he do that so he tunes out the reflection characteristics of his ground, of his trees, and everything else when listening to that signal from London in my experiment? I'll admit that that's not easy. However, it is a deterministic situation. You know where the ground is. You know how many feet you are above the ground. You know where the nearest tree is, and so on. So when it comes to the perturbation to your measurement that you get from the ground, the tree, the gutter from the house, and so on, These things can be quantified, can be measured, and you can extract them from the data after you get the data. There's ways you can work around that. So 30 feet is more than good enough. Is it high enough? For many of these experiments, I think it is. Occasionally, he might want to make the antenna almost at ground level for a secondary experiment. So the proper altitude of the antenna is another one of the variables for his particular backyard. Life ain't simple, but still, don't let that discourage you. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with comments.
Yeah, stand by, John. Go ahead, Glenn. Wait for the beeps.
Hey, good evening, Vic. This polarimetry experiment I've been doing on the, 10 meters, 12, 15, 17, and 20 meter bands, 15 and 20. I've been doing that now approaching 5 years now. I have a rotator on a beam, and I can actually rotate my polarity from vertical to horizontal 45 all the way through. I've got a lot of data now for approaching on 5 years, and very, very interesting data.
Okay, you just dropped a grenade and ran. Hey, Glenn, let's just choose one of those bands, like the 10-meter band, during the time the band is open, and you've got this Yagi antenna where you can rotate it in polarization by rotating it. I'm guessing you've got something like an AR-100 rotator mounted in the middle of the boom of the antenna, so you can rotate the boom to rotate its polarization. It, in turn, is mounted on a mast coming out of the top of your tower, out of the top of your house, so you can rotate it in azimuth. So by way of you listening to 10-meter signals, for instance, coming from London, for instance, my guess is there are some days when slant 45 right gives you the strongest signal and slant 45 left on another day gives you the strongest signal. That's a guess on my part. So if I just restrict myself to the 10-meter band or any other band you want to choose, we've got lots of data. What's your quick recollection, Glenn, of what you remember as to the history, the personality of the 10-meter band for a guy that can measure polarimetry? What have you seen, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, what I've been measuring is very, very stable polarimetry on terrestrial stations. And there's everything that's earthborne. Generally, if the station is received on one date, if one polarization tends to stay in that polarization. What I do notice is that on certain days, signal strength will change, but the polarimetry is almost identical. And the majority of the EX stations on 10 meters that I've had were all in horizontal polarization. The local is tends to be more vertical, but the EXing is probably almost always horizontal. Where I have the most data is on the 20-meter band, because probably EX active most of the year. Very, very consistently, and even through all the solar cycles, but here again, very, very consistently, I have not seen much in the way of different polarizations from the way that they're being translated on the other end, and I've got multiple contacts different times of the year and over different years, similar stations, different locations, Europe, United States, and very, very consistent polarization. In fact, you did K2RIW.
Now, there's something about that that's bothering me a little bit, Glenn. You made it sound like the majority of you picking up the polarization horizontal, and nowhere near as often did the polarization peak vertical, regardless of what the guy was sending out. Is there the possibility that when your rotatable polarization Yagi was vertically polarized, the elements were now parallel to the mast coming out of your tower, and as such you were getting a little bit of detuning or a little bit of blockage, and therefore your particular mechanical arrangement possibly was de-emphasizing vertical, and therefore you would measure less signal vertical than horizontal, even though the signal may have had a lot of vertical component? Is there any possibility of that? Because it sounded like you were saying that vertical was a somewhat more rare polarization in your observations of reception. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
AD2BHY with some further information on the radio, Dick, if you have any time after this.
Okay, you're on the list, Jim. Go ahead, Glenn.
Over the last, you know, 4.5, going on 5 years now, I've checked the polarimetry of the array, and it's pretty much on. If anybody wants to come down and take a look at it, you can see it very, very plainly from the roof, and that's measured by using test sources of known polarizations, especially in the near field, varied, and even from DXing. I've asked stations to vary their polarization. We also have similar capability. And I've been able to also tell people what their polarization is. Certainly, there are some stations that have mounted antennas at different times, different heights, and the way that the antennas were configured, where they weren't even sure of their polarization. I've been able to identify it for them, especially on 20 meters. I've done that quite a bit. But generally, when the antennas are fixed, at fixed altitudes and fixed points, usually their polarization is very consistent. And, in the middle of QSOs, I can actually rotate the beams and let them know, if there's any difference. But what's interesting is when the pull-off happens, it happens on both ends. So there is reciprocity in that. So generally when I start losing them, they lose me. So it's been pretty consistent. And as I said, I haven't really determined any effect of Faraday rotation on the 10 through 20 meter band, in the HF frequency area so far. 80 has been a little bit more problematic. I'm doing that differently, but the problem is I don't have the ability to secure the radio signal. So I don't have the gain that I have with the YAG. It's hard to quantify that the wire antennas that I have on the loop versus my diamond antenna, because the diamond loop is vertically polarized, the horizontal loop is horizontally polarized.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Station 3, but maybe in 40 actually, but I'm working on it. That's where I did the KC2QIQ.
Major audio, NY2H.
Glenn, your very first transmission was nice and loud and dental quieting. All subsequent transmissions became very much noisy, like you were putting out milliwatts of carrier instead of watts of carrier. Is there any possibility of a change in the power output of your transmitter? We heard everything you said, but you became considerably more noisy on the later transmissions. That's item number one. Item number two, you seem to be saying you've never seen any Faraday rotation of polarization. In the case of ground wave signals, that makes some sense. But when it comes to long-range propagated 10 or 20 meter signals, in other words, if you listen to somebody from Europe, are you saying you saw no evidence of polarization rotation, Faraday rotation, in other words, a guy transmitting horizontal and you heard vertical or vice versa? That seems to be what you're saying. And that's quite different than what I expected to hear. Back to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, power output, same on this side, Dick. I don't know if the voting system is maybe picking me up on a different repeater. I've never seen any difference in polarization on one fixed station. As I said, mobile stations, there is some other things going on there, but I'm actually working on that result as well, but that requires some special treatment. But the fixed stations, the base station to base station, ground station to ground station, those we definitely pretty much, don't have any shift in data from Europe to, across the U.S., down to South America. It's pretty consistent polarization there.
I2H was in there.
Yeah, he was recommending that Glenn use a little bit more audio. I'm getting the impression, Glenn, that the vast majority of your receptions appeared to be horizontal and that vertical was the more rare. And if that's true, is there the possibility that the